Good morning. Highway 101 takes us today to the picturesque seaside town of Sausalito, north of San Francisco. It's the first place you hit after driving, cycling, or walking over the iconic Golden Gate Bridge. One of its current residents is a multi-award-winning author and one of the most popular American writers worldwide today. She's been translated into more than 30 languages since the success of her first novel, The Joy Luck Club, in 1989. Since then, she's written four more best-selling novels, the screenplay of Wayne Wang's version of her debut, books for children, and a memoir, The Opposite of Fate. Her apotheosis, however, came when, in the year 2000, she appeared as herself in an episode of The Simpsons called Insane Clown Poppy. Once a year, she dons a scary leather outfit for charity and, along with other famous writers like Stephen King and Scott Turow, plays in a band called the Rock Bottom Remainders. She herself has described their talents as dubious. Amy Tan, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
Can we go back to a time before you were born? Tell me how your mother and father got together.
My mother said it was fate, and my father said it was God's will. They were on a boat going to inland during the war, and they saw each other and struck up a conversation. Didn't see each other for the next 5 years, and then they ran into each other on a street in Tianjin. They saw each other and knew immediately that they were meant for each other. But my mother was married at the time. So it took a little bit of God's will, I think, on my father's part to make sure that it happened.
Your mother had had a miserable first marriage, hadn't she?
She had a marriage to a man she barely knew, and it turned out the man was a liar. He was a cheat in all kinds of things, business and cards and money. He was a philanderer. From the day before they got married and the day after, he turned out to be a pedophile as well, who raped little girls that my half-sisters brought home from school. So he was an evil, evil man. I never knew his name until much later, but my mother referred to a man who wasn't identified as her husband as simply that bad man.
Your father came over to the USA, and in fact, your mother was in jail, and it was only after she came out of jail that she came to the United States of America. Just explain what happened there.
She was jailed because she was having an affair with my father and had run away. And back in those days, a wife didn't have the right to leave a marriage. So she was placed in this jail, and my father ended up leaving for he had a scholarship to MIT. But when he came to the States, he heard God speaking to him. And apparently God said that if you join the ministry, your loved one will be saved and taken out of jail. So she was released. But it was another, I think, 2 years before she did come to the States.
You were also unaware for many years that her mother, your grandmother, had committed suicide, and she actually committed suicide in front of your mother.
She was a beautiful woman who was a widow, the widow of a scholar. And actually, my grandfather, of course, who I never met, died in 1918 during the Great Pandemic, which we now know is the first incident of the bird flu. He died very quickly. My grandmother became a widow, and she was supposed to remain a widow, but she was raped by a rich man, forced to become his concubine, gave birth to that man's first son, and then killed herself in front of my mother. My grandmother told my mother before she died, do not follow my footsteps, meaning be careful not to have this great unhappiness by, you know, relying on your beauty or something. But in fact, that's what happened to my mother. She was such a beauty that somebody took her as his, you know, as his wife. She always blamed all the bad things that happened in her life because of her lack of a mother to guide her.
You came into the world in Oakland, in California, in 1952. What was life like for you as a preteen?
We actually lived throughout the Bay Area, and whenever my mother was upset, she either threatened to kill herself or move back to China or she had to move into a new house. Sometimes it was all three, and you had to pick the best of them, which was, of course, to move houses. And we ended up moving every year. So it was Oakland, and then Fresno, then back to Oakland, then it was Hayward, Santa Rosa, another house. You know, it just went on and on. So my life, in a sense, was lonely. I didn't have friends who remained friends for very long, and I started writing letters to people. Now, on top of this, I had a very religious father who was completely devoted to God, and so there was daily, you know, sort of reverence to God, even setting a place at the dinner table for the unseen guest, which is supposedly Jesus then. And we even had chopsticks. We had a bowl and chopsticks for Jesus. It was a very confusing time because after my father died when I was 15, it turned out my mother was not as religious as my father, and she allowed for other kinds of ghosts to come into the house.
Ghosts are something that occupy a huge part, or certainly did in your childhood, maybe do today as well. But did you, when you were growing up, you were first generation Asian American in the 50s and 60s. Did you encounter issues of race?
The issues of race were different as I was growing up. I had a sense of it when I was 6 years old because some child, some boy on the street called me a very racist name. It was either Jap or Chink. People couldn't really tell the difference between Japs and Chinks. And so I became a Jap. And it was always with a lot of anger and derision because it was after the war. I started looking at myself and seeing what was it about me that was Chinese or different. You know, I'd look at my hands and my feet and my legs and saying, is that Chinese? What makes me Chinese? I was embarrassed of the food that we ate because it was fresh fish, live things, you know, fresh vegetables. You know, why couldn't we have canned food like everybody else? And when I was a teenager, it became my scapegoat, my race, my scapegoat for boys not asking me out, and anything that had to do with not getting what I wanted. My parents held me back, it seemed. Or in other ways, the Chinese background actually did hold me back on IQ tests and achievement tests. I didn't do that well, relatively speaking, to math. So the verbal skills were rated as much lower than my mathematics skill. And as a result, people always discouraged me from doing anything that had to do with verbal skills. By the time I was in college, I think the very first year, it was the awareness now that I was supposed to become a radical and looking completely at the opposite and becoming very angry that I had been denigrated for my race and now do a lot to point out that kind of racism. And that eventually evolved to my working with multicultural programs for the inclusion of Asian families into services for disabled children, and so on and so forth. So what I came to figure out, probably in my early 30s, is that race is never a static issue. And it depends on where you are, what point in your life you are, but also where physically you are. I am never more American than I am when in China. I become so aware that even though I look somewhat the same, that much of who I am just stands out in stark contrast to somebody else who's Chinese.
Anybody who reads your novels thinks they know a lot about your relationship with your mother, whether they do or whether they don't. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with your father. Were you close?
I was what you would call a daddy's girl. I was. He and I were conspirators, oftentimes against the wrath of my mother. She became angry, I remember, one time when I was 8 years old. I don't remember the details except that she took a watermelon and she smashed it on the floor. And my father and I had to take it out to the garbage can. And we sat there and we ate that watermelon and we were laughing and And I was crying, but we were eating it, but we were laughing, and I was crying at the same time. I was at an age where I wanted to be in love. I wanted to have a boy who had a crush on me, and I would have a crush on him, and I would have my first kiss, and I would go to the dance. And all those things that a teenager dreams of, I was not expecting that I would have to deal with double tragedies in our family. My brother having a brain tumor first, and my father and mother trying to beseech all the powers that be, you know, God, ghosts, ancestors, to cure him. And so that was rather a crazy time. And then my father dying, instead of my brother getting well, instead of the miracle happening, my father came down with the same thing, a brain tumor. So I had to deal with not having any boys be in love with me. I had to deal with going to the hospital. And I couldn't talk about any of this. My mother wanted me to cry every day with her, and I refused to cry. I don't think she understood, or a lot of people did not understand, that the ways in which children grieve, or the way, which has a lot to do with being scared. I looked at my diary the year that my father was dying, and what's in there is nothing about sadness. It is the top 100 hits on the radio. I looked at that and I was so shocked, but then I realized, no, that is what I had to do to escape this horror that was happening, including the fact that my mother believed that my younger brother and I were the next to die.
Because obviously she would heap her insecurities and her grief on you, and you're in your early teens, and that must have increased your own insecurities.
She believed that it was a curse, and there was something in the place where we were living, or that the curse had started because of something that happened in our family. And so she was trying to do everything to protect us, both protect us and find out the source, because if she could find out the source, she could prevent it. That led to a big clash, because when you're a teenager, you don't want to be overly protected. You want to set out on your own course and find life. You don't want to listen to anybody's views on what you should believe. You want to go out and get in trouble. I mean, we didn't call it getting in trouble, but you want to do everything that adults tell you you shouldn't do. You want to kiss boys. You want to smoke. You want to drink. You want to go places that you're not supposed to go to. And instead, I had this mother who was constantly worried to the point of suffocation.
And a mother who was also, as you've mentioned, very attuned to the spiritual, to the spirit world, and thought that you had some powers, certain powers.
My mother believed in ghosts, and I didn't realize how strongly she believed in them until my father died, because inviting ghost in your house would be a form of blasphemy. But my mother, every now and then, would say little hints that made me realize she thought there was something else. When I was a little girl, I lied to her. I didn't want to go to the bathroom and brush my teeth and go to bed. And so I told her I was scared, and she said, why? And I said there was a ghost in there, and she took my hand and went to the bathroom. And I think most mothers would have turned on the light and said, you know, there's no ghost, so now brush your teeth. And my mother, she was so excited. She was so happy. And she turned on the light and she said, where is she? And she believed that I was a natural psychic medium. And that belief of hers followed me for the rest of her life. And she thought all the way to the end that I could talk to people and see them. And so I grew up half believing at times. And when I did, I was scared. And because who wants to see a ghost?
You used to have sessions on the Ouija board.
Ouija boards were something that all the kids did. You know, you get this board, and then what we did was ask the spirits, does Billy love me? You know, really serious questions like that. Well, my mother saw me playing with that, and it was after my father and brother died. And she wanted me to use this to communicate with my father and my brother. And I kept saying, it's not how it works. And she insisted. And we would sit there with our hands on this planchette asking questions that were often very sad. And I didn't want to show any emotion. I was still at that state where I would not show how sad I was. She would ask these terribly sad questions. Do you still love me? Do you miss me? Will I ever see you? Do you know I love you? I'm so sorry for this. And I would be the person who have to make up the answers. Make up the answers I knew she wanted to hear. One time she started asking more practical questions. She would talk about the stock market. And she would want to get tips. So she would say, what I should invest in? IBM, U.S. Steel. You know, it was like, oh, my God. You know, and I would make up these answers. And my mother, that's how my mother would invest in the stock market. And it turned out later on, she actually did quite well. She would ask whether she should open a Chinese restaurant. That was a big preoccupation of hers. And what she should sell and what kind of place and where should it be. And all I could imagine was my having to do the dishes. So I just put, you know, kind of quashed that idea and said it was a very bad idea and she'd lose a lot of money. And then she wanted to know what to do with me because I was so awful. And so she would say, you know, I treated her bad, and what should she do? And maybe she'd send me away to Taiwan. And, you know, and then I'd say, no, 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 that's not good. I was just controlling my life barely using the Ouija board. So I found it was very useful. But at the same time, it was scary. It was scary to me.
On something of a whim, your mother decided to move the entire family and resettle in Europe, first in Holland and then eventually in Switzerland. Tell me about your relationship, because you mention it in memoirs and it's alluded to elsewhere, a relationship with a man called Franz.
Franz was my very first boyfriend. Here was the boy who had a crush on me. He was 22, so he was quite a bit older. I was 16. He was referred to somewhere as my older German man, but he was not ancient. He was a hippie. He was a German army deserter. He had an illegitimate child. That's what we called it then. He broke off with his family, and he drank, and he didn't have a job. He played foosball throughout the day. He was very good because he practiced 8 hours a day. You know, he was, for some reason, not my mother's idea of a boyfriend. This guy was so romantic, though. If you're 16 and the guy writes to you 22 pages in this perfect script, the way, you know, the Germans have learned to do this very perfect kind of script, and it's all about love, you know, that is so romantic. You know, I was just, I just thought it was great, even though I couldn't read the letter. It just looked like it was very romantic. There wasn't a single mistake in there. He'd give me gifts. He gave me a tape deck, and my mother made me give that back because she believed that this guy was going to become that bad man. Just like her husband, her first husband. And this guy would cause me to be so sorry that I would kill myself. And the sequence of that was when she told me about birth control when I was 10 and knew nothing about what she was talking about. She'd say, don't let a boy kiss you, because if you do, you can't stop, and then you're going to have the baby, and then you put the baby in a garbage can, and the police going to come and take you away and put you in jail, and you never get out, and you might as well kill yourself right now. You know, I mean, that was how afraid she was of my falling into the hands of a wrong person. She ended up finding a way to get him arrested. I mean, you just didn't mess around with Daisy Tan, you know. She hired a private detective, and he followed us around, and it turned out Franz had a bunch of friends who sold a little hashish on the side. And so they had enough evidence to arrest these guys, the Canadians, and to also arrest Franz and have them put in jail and then deported.
Tell me a bit about the evolution of your relationship with your mother up to the time of her death, because relationships between mothers and daughters change a lot over the years.
I think like a lot of women, I learned not to bring up subjects that were sensitive. And in essence, I would avoid a lot of contact with my mother. I would see her, but I never really talked about anything in my life with her. We had then a kind of rapprochement that had to do with neglect on my part. There was a period, however, when I was 27 or so, and my mother was going back to China for the first time, and she was going to see these daughters from her first marriage. And I had never known about these daughters until I was a teenager, and I didn't really care that much, but when she was about to go there, I felt very threatened. And I believed she would find the daughters she had always wanted, and she'd come back and have no use for me. But instead she came back, and it was as though she loved me even more. And after that, I felt that my mother was somebody with sort of a past that I didn't understand, and that I should get to know that. I didn't really have the strong desire to know everything about my mother's life until I had a scare and I thought she had died. I received a phone call when I was on vacation from a friend who had picked up her answering machine and the messages. And my brother had left a message, being unable to reach me, that our mother had had a heart attack and was taken to intensive care. And it had been 4 or 5 days, and I was certain she had died. And I made this promise to myself and to whoever could make these things happen, God or ghosts or ancestors. I just said, if she lives, I promise I will get to know her. And I promise I'll take her to China. And I got on the phone and was transferred, and suddenly I heard her voice, and it was, Amia, where are you? And she was alive. And she laughed because she was so happy to hear I was worried. It turned out she didn't have a heart attack. She'd had angina. She'd gotten in an argument with somebody at a store over the price of a fish. And now I was able to go back to my vacation, except I heard this voice that said I had made this promise. You know, it's a funny thing. I don't know whether it's superstitious, but you end up feeling that if you don't follow through on the promise, then the thing you were hoping for would revert back to the tragic one. So I did take my mother to China, and I was listening to her stories, and I was at that point starting to write. So I wrote stories using bits of her background, but finding astonishingly enough that the story would go back to a relationship that it had very much to do with me and my mother.
Tell me about the success of the Joy Luck Club and what difference it made to your life.
I was not expecting it. I was never somebody who dreamed even of getting published. And it happened in so many strange ways that it was one time I actually believed there were ghosts who were guiding me along. And if I had decided that I didn't want to write any more stories, they were going to make sure that I continued. Every time I forgot about writing, something would happen. And it led up to this point of getting offers from publishing houses to publish a novel that had not been written. Actually, a collection of short stories based on 3 short stories, an unknown writer. When the book came out, it was reviewed as a novel, and suddenly it caught on, and who knows why. My editor wasn't expecting it. I certainly wasn't expecting it. And it just kept going and going, and then it hit the New York Times bestseller list, and it just took off. I was shocked, and I kept telling my husband that this is going to go away. You know, the average life of a book is 6 weeks, and then it's off the shelves. And whatever this is, it's happening now. We can't get used to it because it's not going to be there. And then it kept going and going and going, and I started getting sales from foreign, the overseas publishers. And still I kept saying, it's going to stop, it's going to stop. And it wasn't until October of that year. It was published in March. And in October, my husband and I were walking around a lake, and I said to him, you know, I think I can do this forever.
Was it hard to lose your mother piece by piece from Alzheimer's?
You know, it really was, I think, it was not as bad a disease as it is for other families who are losing their parents and watching them lose their mind. And that is because my mother lost memories of things that were tragic. She became happy for the first time. She would say to me, I'm happy. I have no worries. I never thought I would hear my mother say that. She would put me in her memories from the past. She would say, do you remember when I met your daddy? You took me to the dance and you pushed me toward him and you smiled and then you backed away. And you were very naughty, but, you know. So she would have me there at some of the happiest times in her life. She would become delusional and upset. And I think that was what was the most upsetting thing, and it is for most people, when people become psychotic, and you cannot talk them out of that psychosis. But I discovered that there was something that where you could go to a part of the memory or to emotions that answered those things, that countered them. And so when she believed, for example, that my husband was having an affair with one of our friends and going to Lake Tahoe to do this, and that she had been there and watched all this, I suddenly realized after arguing with her, you know, how could you have gone there? And I said, you know, you're right. I've kicked him out of the house. My husband was standing there like, what's going on here? I was talking to her on the telephone, and I said, I've kicked him out. And she was, oh, that's good. And I said, yeah, and you are such a good mother. You are the only one who worries for me. You are the only one who can protect me from what's bad. And she said, yes, you know, yes, yes, that's what I want to do. I said, you are the best person in the world. She was so grateful. And then she said, are you scared? And I said, well, a little. The house is so big, but soon I'll be living in a much smaller house. And she said, why? And I said, well, you know, when we divorce, he'll get half. But if I marry, you know, that'll be good. But of course, if I divorce then, I'll have even a smaller house because that guy will get half. And pretty soon she was encouraging me to make up with Lou. And after that, she never brought up this delusion that I should leave him, that he was having this affair. And that was what I learned. That was what was so wonderful for the two of us, is that I finally realized what I knew about my mother. All I had to do was tell her what she always wanted to hear before she was sick, and now when she was losing her mind, that she was the best mother, that she was the one who knew me the best and worried for me the most, and worry equated to the greatest kind of love.
Was it very difficult to adapt?
I'm always so willing to start over again. I think many have this notion that writers are going to be so protective that they need to put everything in. They fought for every word, which contains every emotion, every experience. But what I found with the help of wonderful director Wayne Wang and the other screenwriter, Ron Bass, is that we would find the heart of the story, the heart of the soul of the story, the emotions that had put it together. And we would find out what each of those characters had as part of that soul. And then we could start again. The stories are very much the way they are in the book, but they are shaped differently according to that framework. And so it became very easy in a way. There is an opening to the movie, and it's about Swan Feather. And it is the very beginning of the book. It's an epigraph, and it goes like this. The old woman remembered a swan she had bought many years ago for a foolish sum. And it goes on, this tale of bringing this swan that gets taken away from her and being able to keep only one feather that she's going to one day give to her daughter, who would one day understand her once she begins to speak in perfect English. Ron wanted to start the movie with that. And I said, thinking I knew everything about film, I said, oh, Ron, that's just a bunch of words. You know, we need to see something. And Ron just looked at me and said, what are you talking about? That is the story. That is the whole book. And it was true. I had written that piece at the end of writing the entire book. It was what I had learned in writing that book. And he had gotten that. And he wanted to keep it in the film. And he said, if anything, we should have more of it. We should open with it. We should have a scene in there in the middle. And we should have a scene in the end of the movie. And he was right.
On Highway 101, I'm talking today to author Amy Tan, American-born daughter of Chinese parents and vocalist with the singularly unsuccessful but well-intentioned garage band Rock Bottom Remainders. Tell me why a respectable award-winning author dresses up once a year for a week or so in a red wig and leathers and becomes the vocalist for a band whose output she herself describes as dubious.
I think I'd have to go to a psychiatrist to figure that out. There are so many reasons for that. The first one was I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I didn't know that I'd really have to sing into a microphone and before a very large audience. Once we did this first show, Stephen King, Dave Barry, Scott Turow, Barbara Kingsolver, Matt Groening, we were elated because we were alive. That was the most scary thing any of us had ever done. We thought we were going to die a number of times, and afterward we were ecstatic. And it was supposed to be a one-time thing, but pretty soon, I think within the first week, we started talking about doing another one. Only this one would be a bus tour on Aretha Franklin's bus, and we would go to 10 cities on the East Coast and play in real rock and roll venues. We got out of hand, but to make it seem, you know, it was self-indulgent, but we wanted to justify it, so we were going to raise money for charity. And we picked out First Amendment rights, you know, non-censorship, and the first thing that should have been censored was us. We did this, and we were bad, and we became less and less bad, but we were always bad. And that led to part of our shtick. Part of our reputation had to do with how bad we were, but how much we didn't take ourselves seriously. That's the danger, you know, if you take yourselves too seriously, then you're pathetic. And we had some guest writers. Some of them, I'm sorry to say, they were from the UK. Or maybe, you know, it's good for your listeners to know. They were from the UK, and we won't mention their names, but they...
One of them was from, well, you've had a Frank McCourt, haven't you?
Frank is great. Frank is not the ones that I'm talking about. Frank does not take himself seriously. He'll sing Danny Boy as well as some Beatles song, and he'll be playing the harmonica. But we'll find out halfway through he's playing a different Beatles song than what he said he was going to play. It all sounds the same, so it doesn't matter. It became a joke. But then we would get invited to places like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And we were invited to play at the dinner with all the real rock and roll stars the day before the opening. And we were scared, you know, because the real singers were there. Bruce Springsteen was there. It was phenomenal. We've been able to play with so many great musicians. Al Kooper was our first musical director who whipped us into shape. And literally gave me the whip, told me that I should sing this song, Boots. These boots are made for walking. And his further suggestion was that I whip the boys at the end of the song. At the end, you know, I'd say, boots are made for walking. They're going to walk all over you. And then, boys, you've been bad, you know, bend over. And then I would whip them. And the audience would go insane. It didn't matter how, you know, how horribly I sang. They just suddenly thought I was the the greatest. It was scary, you know, and I'd have people come up to me after the show, and that's what they thought was my persona, that I was some dominatrix who went around whipping people and telling them to get on their hands and knees and scrub the toilet or something. And, you know, I was in Germany recently, and there was some man who said, you know, you can come to my country anytime, you know, and whip me. Or I thought, oh, that's sick. What is it? It's a gag. It's a joke. But that's the kind of thing that happens in the band. And that's what makes it so incredibly fun. We're having fun together, and we are such good friends now. We just love to get together.
Tell me about your experience of entering the new American pantheon and of playing yourself on The Simpsons.
That is probably my biggest claim to fame, I think. I'm finding it, especially among the teen groups. Well, I got on there because Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, asked us, a number of us, if we would appear on the show. And we would appear as ourselves, going to a book fair and talking to some of the people there. He included Stephen King and Maya Angelou, who never was with our band, but and John Updike, who also never was with our band, but he had the best line for John Updike. John Updike, I think, doesn't even say anything, but somebody says, "Shut up, Updike, shut up, Updike," you know, to this great writer. Mine was having Lisa say to me, "Oh, Mrs. Tan, I love the way you portray mothers and daughters and that whole relationship." And I'd say, "That's not what I was doing at all, you know, you stupid twit. Sit down, I'm ashamed for the both of us." Now, I had to do that 100 times. Matt had me, he would laugh hysterically, and he'd say, "Okay, be mean this time, you know, be even meaner." So I'd say, I'd do another take, and I'd say, "You stupid little girl, you know, how'd you get in?" I would just do different iterations. And then I think they chose one that was fairly mild. But at the same time, I think that people thought maybe that's how I really would be with little girls who came and told me that they loved my books. I can assure you, I would never say that to anybody. But it was fun. And it's also the only film experience in which I receive residuals. I've never received residuals from my movies or for the cartoon series that I've done or any of that. But The Simpsons, my little one-minute appearance, you know, I get at least $30 a year.